Welcome, everyone. This is The LaRouche Show for Saturday, November 27th, 2010. I'm Marcia Mary Baker, and our topic today is sovereignty and the North American Water and Power Alliance approach, the NOAPA approach. Now, if that sounds very general, which was posted on our website days ago, it's because I think we had the sixth sense some weeks ago, one of our guests, when we discussed this, that the three guests I'll be introducing, who are all speaking to us today from different points in Europe, we wanted to have them on because of their involvement in important work in Africa, but we knew with the rapidity and importance of unfolding events, namely the blowout of the British imperial, the monetarist system we've had for decades, that who knows what we'd need to be discussing today in some detail. So that said, I'll just say that it's the nation-state system itself when we're talking about sovereignty, and it's the condition of humanity on the planet that's at stake. I'm not exaggerating. We're in a kind of turning point situation, which our guests will discuss. So I'm happy to introduce, as I say, the three people from Europe. Let's begin with in Germany. We have Portia Turumbort-Streed. Portia, welcome.
Hello, Marcia.
And she, a month ago, was in Chad for a conference whose title was something like Save Lake Chad. That's a great thing. And accompanying her for the Schiller Institute, Portia, I think you are the vice president of the Schiller Institute, right?
That's correct.
Accompanying her from France, we have on the line Sebastian Paramani. Are you there?
Hello, Marcia. Yes, I'm here.
Welcome. You're in Paris, I believe.
Yes, I'm right now in Paris, yeah.
And he's been very active with the many activities, but the Jacques Cheminade for President campaign that you've been hearing about. Jacques has been interviewed on our show. And my co-host, Harley Schlanger, has been traveling in Europe, especially in France. But I want to welcome from Wiesbaden in Germany, Claudio Celani. Welcome, Claudio.
Hi, good morning or good day.
Good day. And you also have the Italian desk, do you not, of Executive Intelligence Review?
That's right.
So let me just begin. As I said before, we may have had a general title, but what we've got in our hands, I'm just going to give in a nutshell kind of introduction and then turn it over to our guests. But after decades of the British imperial, the kind of world imperium of financial interests that since 1971 also was known as the Inter-Alpha Group, after their destructive financial looting in places around the world. But in the case of Ireland, where they have various connections, you've had the buildup of really unpayable, rotten debts. But just this past week, people know from the headlines that a hideous package was devised for the people of Ireland through their government to agree that institutions like the European Central Bank or the International Monetary Fund would loan money to these zombie debt-ridden, rotten banks, but it would be backed up by taxing and oppressing the Irish people, cutting their government functions for several years by at least 10%, levying new taxes on their homes, unemploying people. And the Prime Minister of Ireland, Brian Cohen, during the week said he would sign off on it. There is a huge push by the political elements I just mentioned, the IMF, the City of London, to have some kind of deal like this signed by tomorrow night, Sunday night. So to speak, markets can open Monday morning, which is a mirage anyway, because the whole thing is falling apart. And in any case, this has to be put before the government of Ireland. The Prime Minister hardly has only has a couple votes or so majority, which won't have no reason to hold up. But yesterday there was a by-election in West Donegal, And the ruling government party of Brian Cohen lost like crazy, was routed by a Sinn Féin candidate. I think his name is Doherty. And I'm just giving you indicative a sense of things. Today was a demonstration, a march in Dublin, in which the representatives of the umbrella trade union group there, the ICTU, which represents 800,000 workers in Ireland. I heard there were as many as 100,000 people at the march, but whoever turned out in the cold, there's no question that this is like a reenactment. In fact, it's in the same streets as the 1916 Easter uprising against the oppression of the city of London and Britain. So, in fact, what we have is a situation here of some kind of package deal of oppression that's being attempted to be imposed on Ireland. No reason to think it's going to be successful politically at all. And in any case, we face chain reactions of non-payment of debts zinging all over Europe, all over the European Union, zinging around internationally. So let me just conclude by saying Mr. LaRouche in the last 72 hours has issued many statements and comments about this, one key element of which is don't go linear. Don't try and predict anything. We have, it's not merely a fluid situation, but you now have to act and intervene on principle. I'll mention a couple things, because look on his political action committee, the LaRouchePAC.com, and you'll see today posted the funeral march of our marionettes. We can get to it. We won't interpret that. Just look at it for yourself. And I do want to say that here on Thanksgiving weekend in the United States, this is an important historic holiday. Goes back to many people, including Abraham Lincoln. Mr. LaRouche did issue another statement I call your attention to called The Present Fall of the House of Windsor. That's what speaks for itself. That's what kind of... We have a Thanksgiving opportunity. We also can face doom if we don't act. So before we get to Africa, or let me say we will do so in the course of the hour, I want to first raise to Claudio and Portia the fact that, gee, it was only weeks, if not months ago, that it would be unthinkable to discuss a resumption of nationhood in Europe and an ending of the euro, the currency, the mega state concept, and return to national currencies. But this is now under discussion. And I mentioned, Portia, when you and Sebastian were in Africa, it was just about 1 month ago, and I understand that you began your speech at the conference there on Save Lake Chad by saying that you can't do anything unless you understand the financial breakdown context we're in. So why don't you go ahead with that, please?
No, because what is clear from the things you've just gone through is that the euro is on its deathbed. It's gone. The collapse is now. It's part of an international breakdown of what LaRouche identified as the Inter-Alpha Group. Because looking at it, just taking it a step back, looking at the fact that in spring this year, Greece was the first country that was that needed a bailout. And just, you know, at the end of the year, we're now in December, you have every day a new country joining the list. You had this troika in Ireland coming a week or so ago into Ireland. They were not invited. It was the IMF, the European Commission, the European Central Bank representatives. And you have to think about the nerve of this, because Ireland had said they did not want this bailout. They had had enough money to get to the middle of next year. And this was basically forced down their throats. And now they're discussing Portugal. Portugal is being put under pressure to receive what is called a preemptive bailout. And now Spain, Italy, Belgium, maybe even France are being discussed. And the Irish are not taking this lying down. I mean, what you talked about, that the Sinn Féin has won a very significant by-election, basically as pointing towards the fall of the Cohen government very, very soon. So they're trying to actually push through this bailout, which has now come out, that Ireland is going to be forced to pay 6 to 7% interest on the portion of the loans it's going to be getting from the European Commission. Has been received with absolute outrage, and rightly so. Because you've come to a point where it's not about these countries at all. It's really about the banks that are completely bankrupt. And sitting here in Germany, what has now been discussed in one of the largest tabloids of the German newspapers, the Bild-Zeitung, is that Germany is going to be the payer of last resort. That at the end of the day, if you take this long laundry list of the countries that might be needing a bailout in the coming period, Germany also is going to go bankrupt unless we get a global Glass-Steagall implemented. And this is something that anybody sitting in a third world country today or in the diaspora coming from a third world country has to understand, that without this sort of reorganization of the banking system, without Germany, for example, having an early exit out of the euro, a collapse is inevitable, and it's not possible to do anything about what's going on in Africa, because the bailout fund that's being discussed is not just 750 billion euros. They're talking about 1.5 trillion now, and that's just leading to hyperinflation. So, you know, the austerity policies that are being forced upon the populations of Ireland, of all these countries, Spain, Greece, Germany as well, is going to lower the potential of these countries being able to pay it back. So what are they going to do? What's plan B? Plan B is printing more money, and the investors are fleeing the state bonds of Ireland and so on. They have their interest rates up at 9.5%. That's normally, people talk about 5% being the pain threshold, and that's just going to exacerbate the situation further. So what we're looking at right now is that ever since these bailouts began, the banks that are actually receiving these monies, they're not putting it under the mattress, so to speak. They're actually pushing that into more speculation, because they now know that whatever happens, whatever they invest in and they lose, the governments are going to pay. They're going to foot the bill. So what's happening is the explosion of prices in raw materials, especially food raw materials. And that, for countries that are mainly raw material exporters, such as countries in Africa, you're seeing price hikes of 30 to 40% on staples. That's genocide on a mass scale. And this is the real crime that we're seeing. You have a drop in living standard in Europe that is very dramatic. But that is all because of the way the system has been built up. And without going to LaRouche's alternative, we're not going to see any type of change anytime soon. The collapse is now. And there are also some interesting things happening in Italy, so I would ask Claudio to go into that, because they're discussing it, getting out of the euro.
Okay. Please, Claudio. Thank you.
Well, I mean, Portia mentioned Plan B in terms of the oligarchy's Plan B, which is to have an hyperinflation in the effort of bailing out the banks. We have been calling for a Plan B for another purpose, a real Plan B, and especially Helga Zepp-LaRouche has been calling for a Plan B for exiting out of the euro, or a Plan B in the worst case scenario when the euro collapses, and she has insisted on this. Now, It's very interesting and ironical that today in Germany, for the first time, a member of the opposition, a leading member of the opposition, comes out and says, does the government have a plan B in case of collapse of the euro? And in Italy, this has been now for, I think, 1 week by now, in the last week or 10 days, has been openly called for by a leading member of the establishment, whose name is Paolo Savona. He has been a minister in 1995 in a center-left government. He started his career actually at the Bank of Italy. I remember I met him once 20 years ago. He was head of the research, the think tank, the research office of the Bank of Italy. And he runs now, he is chairman of the Italian equivalent of the FDIC.
Deposit insurers.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the insurance against, insurance of deposits, right?
Yes.
Of people's deposits. Now, the difference is that in the United States, this is a government body or a government-sponsored institution. In Italy, it's private. It's a fund which all chartered banks are obliged by law to contribute into, right?
Yes.
Which guarantees a certain amount. So he's the head of this, and therefore he's part of the banking establishment. It's ironical that he comes out now with proposing a plan B from getting out of the euro, saying that the European Union and the euro especially has become for Italy a noose tightening around its neck.
Uh-huh.
And Italy should get out of this, throw this rope away before it's too late. So here, I think this reflects a split in the Italian establishment, which he represents, because he himself several years ago was totally on the other line. But now people have realized what this means, because Italy has a huge debt, the largest state debt in the world, and it does not have the largest economy in the world to support this debt. The positive side of Italy's debt is that half of it is towards it's a domestic debt. Italian families who have invested their money into government bonds. But half of this debt is international as a result of political shifts about 10 years ago. And therefore, Italy is exposed not so much as Ireland and Portugal, but Italy is exposed in the moment when this the crisis sharpens, and if the Italian bonds are attacked and the costs rise, then Italy is faced with insolvency. Now, this is a remote option for now, but Savona says, let's not wait for that to occur. Let's move preemptively. And so he has called for a national debate on this, and the debate has not exploded really, but yesterday, one among the well-known liberal economists has been chosen to answer him. So now we have a debate, and I call this the Britannia faction. The Britannia faction Britannia being the name of the British royal ship.
Yeah, the yacht.
Well, yacht, right, the yacht.
Uh-huh.
Because this has become well-known in Italy and actually worldwide, because we exposed it in 1992. There was a meeting at the on the British royal yacht Britannia off the coast of Italy with the city bankers and Italian officials to discuss privatization and liberalization. So this was 1992. And EIR exposed it, and now this has become a real popular label to identify this faction, which I think in your hemisphere is known as the comprador affection, right?
Yes.
You can identify it like...
Well, call them aliens. And
the aliens, yes. Or the pirateers.
Okay, pirateers.
Pirates. So, but I would like to go back to the nature of the crisis, which comes out now as the euro crisis, which Porsche addressed as being not the nature a crisis of the euro, but a crisis of the global financial and monetary system, which is now exploding in its in the weakest segment of its transatlantic component, right?
Uh-huh.
Why? Because it's a banking crisis. And it's centered on Ireland because the euro was nothing else than the instrument set up for the prosecution of what was started in 1971 by this group called Inter Alpha. And it was nothing else than the building up of a private monetary system, Venetian style or Venetian Anglo-Dutch style. And this at the same time when Nixon broke up the Bretton Woods system, right, which was fundamentally was a credit system, an imperfect but a credit system. So this group of banks was set up in 1971 with the purpose of building up a private monetary system where money and credit is created by private entities, which are these banks. Money is traded as a commodity, and they fix the value of the money, and that's what then became the euro. Now, the Inter Alpha Group is therefore important and central to the present system, also because of its dimensions. I mean, they control a lot of this monetary system, but especially, I think, because of its function, because that's the center of where the system functions. It's also because of its dimensions. I mean, if you take one member of this group, which is the Royal Bank of Scotland, the Royal Bank of Scotland is exposed now for 65 billion euros towards Ireland. And if you take another bank in Belgium, the Credit Bank, the Credit Bank alone is exposed for half of the overall Belgian exposure to Ireland.
Uh-huh.
And now Belgium is a tiny country, and therefore, in absolute terms, this is not much. But it's you see that they are the first row, and so this creates an immediate interest for this group to bail out Ireland because Ireland was a sort of carry trade operation for the euro system. The euro system has become a center of cheap money creation for all sorts of speculative derivative carry trade operations, and Ireland was one of these operations. Carry trade probably is not the correct form, but it was some sort of subprime investment area, right? A tax haven area, and this has collapsed. But this is just, as I said, one segment of the whole system, and this is coming down, right? Now, by the way, the interesting thing, and this I think should be raised in the United States, guess who insured the outstanding debt, the exposure of these British Inter Alpha banks to Ireland?
Oh, you mean these credit default swaps characters?
Right.
Who?
Right. In other words, Royal Bank of Scotland has, say, X billions of toxic assets in Ireland, which probably will never be paid.
Right.
And guess who insured this through credit default swaps? American banks.
Yes.
So it's insured in the United States.
Yes. I wonder, were you going to name names? But, I mean, you only have the few. And J.P. Morgan,
Goldman Sachs, you name them.
And it's, as they did domestically, rope in states, local cities, states, water districts, universities to buy their credit default swaps. Although you're talking about in Ireland these pyramids of unpayable speculative transactions that there are these CDSs on.
Right. I mean, in Ireland, they created a real estate boom, right? Building up offices and houses which were bought and sold only, but never inhabited, right?
Right.
And right. So And then they securitized the future income of such of such houses and sold them. These are the securities, and that's what the debt is.
Well, and I think people think back. They also did this with farmland, and Ireland would be a great cheese exporter to the world. And here you have a small place that everything was securitized, speculated upon, and this was known as the Celtic Tiger, I believe.
Mm. Yes, yes.
But Marcia, I want to go into something at this point, which maybe listeners in the United States don't really have consciously, the question of why the euro doesn't work.
Please.
Because, you know, I remember a couple of years ago, everybody was going out of, you know, dollars thinking, you know, the euro is stronger and so on and so forth. Even the Chinese and so on were falling into this trap. But, you know, as Lyndon LaRouche was saying at that point, he was saying, well, it's like when you have two people falling out of an airplane, you know, the fatter guy just falls faster. but you know, so it seems like the other guy is rising when they're both falling, you know, in terms of looking at the euro and the dollar. But the euro is also falling like a stone. And the question of why the euro doesn't work goes back to this issue of how it was set up. Helga, Mrs. LaRouche is always discussing this issue of why you had the euro in the first place. The people who were behind it, as Claudio was saying, knew that the euro would not work, because if you have a country like Germany, which is an industrial powerhouse, they export high technologies, and then you have this country tied in one a monetary union to countries that are mainly based on agriculture, like Greece and so on. It doesn't function simply because what happens is that all the exports, the money gained from the surplus in exports for Germany were actually used to finance this housing boom and so on and so forth, in Ireland, in Greece and so on and so forth. So you had the question of the euro actually going back before the euro was actually printed as a currency, was actually monetized. You had the Maastricht Treaty, which was brought about by a ménage à trois, as Mrs. LaRouche was talking about, of you know, Thatcher, Mitterrand, and George Bush Sr., where at the point where Germany was going for reunification, there was a huge freakout because the Deutschmark was a solid currency, and they wanted to make sure that this didn't extend to the former Common states to build up industry there, because they wanted a depot for, you know, cheap labor and so on and so forth as an extension of the, you know, imperial system of globalization. And so what happened was that Bush Sr. was discussing this whole question of how do you get Germany to basically be bound by a corset without having to do anything from the outside. And so they had this question of the stability pact, where they said that over 3% of the GDP, you cannot invest more than 3% of the GDP. That means anything in terms of large infrastructure projects, large scale and long-term projects, that was out of the picture. And then, you know, the question of deregulation that occurred as a result of this, in terms of building up a new bubble, these bubbles all over Southern Europe and so on, you know, came to a point where Larry Summers, 99, basically took away Glass-Steagall. And this is what led into a breaking point in 2007 with the housing crisis in the United States, where you had money flooding the markets for speculation, and banks that had, you know, 4 to 5% profits, you know, which was at that point, you know, a lot, but decent, they started making 25% profits. Now, you don't make 25% profits based on long-term investments in infrastructure, but
no,
you make
only at the gaming table, right?
Exactly, in a casino economy. And this sort of thing is now going into, like I said, food, raw material speculation, and so on and so forth. And what happened is the Germans know that this sort of process is going to lead to hyperinflation. And they have the picture of 1923, where within a short period of time, you know, bread was, you know, a billion Reichsmarks. They have this in their bones. And this mini baby steps that Mrs. Merkel and Schäuble were taking in terms of banning short selling in the spring of this year, or the hesitation to go for the 750 billion euro bailout for Greece and so on, or what Mrs. Merkel was discussing in terms of the haircut for banks, that banks should also take the hit. And maybe get, I don't know, 40 cents on the euro for their investments and so on. That unleashed a huge attack on Germany, where you had people like Jean-Claude Juncker, who's the head of the Eurogroup, saying that Germany has lost sight of the common good of Europe. somebody who discusses, you know, eroding the whole sovereignty of European nation states, saying that if they accept, you know, what the European Union lays out in terms of restricting the sovereignty of nations, and that goes unopposed, they would go further and further until there was no turning back. This sort of guy does not think about, you know, the common good of Europe at all. But this thing is coming down faster than most people can imagine. I make a joke to people that I discuss with, saying that, you know, you could have the Deutschmark back before Christmas. You know, and people say, really? You know, it's a polemic. I don't know. But in terms of just thinking about before the euro was introduced, if you had 10 Deutschmark in your pocket, you could basically buy the equivalent of what you buy now for 20, 25 euros. So people know this. They know the hyperinflation that's actually inbuilt in the system. And this is what is fueling the revolt here, small as it may be, but this is actually the question on the table.
Well, maybe we could ask Sebastian about, speaking of revolt, we see in France, we've seen a repeated mass actions and so forth. You have the whole Jacques Cheminot campaign. Would you speak about the same sense of uprising, limitations and opportunities, Sebastian?
So first of all, and I think because it's the most important thing to say at this moment from here, you know, and which is directly connected to the question of sovereignty, which we are discussing right now. You know, France, as you knew it 2 days ago, doesn't exist anymore. Everything is changing every day, you know, here. And why I'm saying that? Because yesterday, an historical event, you know, occurred where truth, or at least a part of it, was in our mass media with the publication of the biggest newspaper in France, which is called Le Monde, of an article, you know, called Little Account Among Wise Men, exposing the shameful action of our politicians and their underlings during the 1995 presidential campaign, in which Jacques Cheminade was at this time and he was already candidate, you know, at this time, denouncing the folly of the city of London, the Wall Street crowd, and the Maastricht Treaty and the euro destruction of our nation state. So you have Le Monde acknowledge publicly, you know, that the Constitutional Council in its 1995 presidential campaign ruling validated the campaign account of Prime Minister Edouard Balladur and President-elect Jacques Chirac at this time, despite the fact that they violated the required condition and therefore the campaign finance accounts should have been rejected. So instead of that, they rejected the one of Jacques Cheminade, which is totally crazy and we can say funny at the same time, because they rejected it because he received a no-interest loan. So it's crazy. So it's clear, you know, that in this system, this oligarchical European system, you can't go to jail or be ruined, as Jacques was at those times, because you are doing something good as a no-interest loan, you know, as he did. And as one of my close associates was saying here, maybe this wise man, you know, suspect Cheminade of being a Muslim because of that. But more interesting, you know, the next day you have the Agence France-Presse, which is the new services of French publication, called 1995 campaign account, former candidate Chaminade demand justice. And they expose the whole story, what we call here the Balladur gate, or which is in fact a Sarkozy gate.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And publishing the communique of Jacques Cheminade directly, the answer of Jacques Cheminade to the article of Le Monde, mm-hmm. and quoting Jacques Cheminade saying that these facts are extremely serious on the institution of our republic, insofar that they are accompanied with suspicion that political campaigns have been financed by kickbacks.
Uh-huh.
And the AFP, which is the Agence France-Presse, is ending this paper saying that still today, which is 15 years later, the French state is still suing Jacques Cheminade for the repayment of 173,000 euro still today. So there is no bailout, you know, for Jacques Cheminade, but bailout for the banks, for the BNP Paribas and all these associates of the euro system. So it's totally a new situation. As you say at the beginning, you know, nothing is predictable right now. You know, 2 days ago, nobody and not the media was talking about what we are doing, and now they open the doors, you know. And this story of this 1995 campaign, you know, is all around the media today and allow people to understand what we are in a such mess, you know, right now. So you have this spark, you know, of truth because of the uprising in the population. The fight we are doing every day, you know, daily basis, organizing, street organizing with this Glass-Steagall, this Bretton Woods, this La Roche-Plan, you know, and this spark of truth, you know, can be and has to be a beginning for our country to recover its sovereignty and kick, you know, this bastard out of our presidential system, you know, as De Gaulle wanted it. So that's why Jacques will be candidate, you know, for the 2012 election, which is now. And it's how we are presenting it to the people because the euro collapse is now. So we are fully mobilized, you know, because it's impossible to have any sovereignty, you know, for a country or even for the individuals where corruption is all over the place. And, you know, and truth is just rejected in hell, you know. But now it's changing in France. So that's the fun part, you know. Even it's becoming much more dangerous because, as it was said by Portia, you know, it was Mitterrand in particular with Jacques Delors, which is one of the founders of Europe, who destroyed the French Glass-Steagall because we had a Glass-Steagall in France until 1984, you mm-hmm. know. And this Jacques Delors destroyed it under the direction of Mitterrand and Thatcher and all these people. So now, at least for France, everything is new, you know, with Jacques Cheminade on the place. So we have doors, medias open for Jacques, you know, to discuss the real issue, which is the global Glass-Steagall. And a lot of people, I can tell you, are freaking out totally of that. And just to finish, you know, for example, today we have two teams, one in Paris and one in Rennes in our West Coast. And these two teams, you know, have been attacked violently by two organized, we can say, militia, you know, who came and one of my friends, you know, has to go to the emergency because he received a headbutt, you know, in his face. So then they are using fascist left wing, you know, to try to stop us. But I think it will be very hard for this European oligarchy, you know, to stop the truth to come and push for this global Glass-Steagall.
Yes, and there again, just all the many things you describe, it's as if this is a contradiction, but it's as if drastic change is already becoming routine. I know that's contradictory, but it's another way to say, and from that point of view, everything you say about Germany, Italy, France, it's all done in the aura and impact of what's happening in Ireland, even though it's not linearly direct. But we can expect certain things.
You know, we have just to say one more thing. You know,
please.
We have a guy yesterday, we called the office, which is living in Ireland.
Okay.
And this tribute this morning in the demonstration, something like, it's not so much, but it's 500 of the Jacques Declaration on the Euro crisis and the destruction of Ireland by the Inter Alpha Group. So we are there also.
I was just going to say, Jacques Cheminade's issued that. He also, I'll throw in the spirit of what you're saying, I know he's issued a statement on Haiti. Helga Zepp-LaRouche issued a message, and I'd like people to know who are listening now or to the archive broadcast that last night, that would be November 26th, Friday, in Haiti, there was a meeting of 2,500 people in the northern coastal town of Cap Haïtien that heard an address by Helga Zepp-LaRouche calling for an international action in the spirit of the great American leader Frederick Douglass, Operation Frederick Douglass, to intervene and make this, with all the emergencies and rebuilding measures, and this grouping of 2,500 people was addressed by Jean-Philippe Leblou from the Montreal office of the International LaRouche Movement, and by other people there. And this, as the gentleman who coordinated it in Cap Haïtien said, this is just the beginning. So it's the non-linearity, and that's despite the tremendous suffering. And I want to ask, we can go back and forth on this. People should know this is the November 27th, 2010 LaRouche Show. And let me repeat who our guests are. Claudio Celani, who's speaking to us from Wiesbaden, Germany. Portia Turumvorst-Street from nearby in Germany. And from Paris, Sebastian Paramani. But the response in Africa, just in brief, Portia, when you laid out the timing, the what's happening on a world scale, I presume, maybe in discussions afterwards, some of the attendees could appreciate it, that it isn't going to be just a continuation. We're at a turning point, one for good or for bad. Is that right?
Well, Africans know that they're at a crossroads because in the recent period, something that has freaked out a lot of Europeans especially is that the Chinese are in Africa in a massive way, building infrastructure, building dams, railroads, trains, highways, and such things. And on the other hand, what you had at this conference in N'Djamena was that the so-called experts, scientific experts, they were discussing the whole environmentalist question, biodiversity, how are you going to save the fish or the worms in the area of Lake Chad, which was, you know, in a certain sense, they swallowed it because this is the usual garbage that comes from Europe, despite the fact that Copenhagen was a failure. Cancun threatens to be the same dismal failure. But, you know, this is what they were discussing. And when I came up and spoke about what the LaRouche movement is doing internationally with NAWAPA, with the Eurasian Land Bridge, our mobilization in Africa for the Transaqua, what large-scale infrastructure projects in terms of water management and these types of things, first of all, what you had was a huge shock. That you had something else coming out of Europe in terms of you know, a vision for Africa. And I can tell you one thing. The Africans, the Arabs, they were ecstatic. They were really happy in terms of the question of nuclear power, you know, because you have huge amounts of uranium in Chad, as well as all over the place in Africa. In terms of raw materials, Africa is, you know, it's just floating on top of a huge amount of raw materials. Why not use that for nuclear power development, using the resources that Africa has in terms of developing energy flux density for rebuilding their nation. So the question of saving Lake Chad was not a single issue, as I brought up, but rather the question of how do you have an approach to really develop Africa in terms of a crash program, the same way that FDR, Franklin Roosevelt, did it in the 30s and 40s in the United States, what happened with Germany with the Marshall Plan. Why don't you do it with Africa? You have, in terms of the potential in Africa, it's clear the Chinese would not be doing it unless they were getting something out of it. What is the issue? And the issue is this green fascist ideology that was absolutely clear in terms of one professor discussing the taboo of Malthusianism needing to be lifted in terms of we have to discuss population explosion in the area, which is the reason why Lake Chad is, shrinking. Not discussing the fact that most of the population growth has not been of the indigenous population, but rather the populations of the countries around coming to a place where there's actually water there for them to use. And this was something that they received with a lot of, I would say, with a lot of irony, because on the other hand, you had all the Europeans booing the idea of nuclear power. But this is the way. This is what Africans want for their future, and that's that would be the message, the same message that Lin had when he came back from Burma, in terms of or India, what they wanted for their future. They want high technologies for their future, and that's what Europe should offer them instead of this whole question of governance, and giving them crumbs if they behave themselves like children. This is really what they responded to.
And well, let me ask in that vein, Sebastian, you can always throw something in, but Claudio, you've been working with one of the people that we've been remustering, the people in North America, Asia, and Europe and Africa who wanted to go ahead with things 40 years ago, right? Would you speak about the Transaqua project in a thumbnail sketch?
Right. Well, this is a fascinating project, which Porsche already mentioned, and it's what she represented there, what she presented there at the conference in Chad. It's fascinating from many aspects. First, because of the approach. The approach is that that this group of people, these are all engineers, they were working in the what became then the largest engineering company in Italy. At that time was state-owned. And they had an office called Office of Special Projects. And after having worked a lot in Africa in building dams, irrigation projects, agricultural projects, etc., then they realized that what you need for Africa, you need large projects. There is no way you can solve problems in Africa by building one road, one thing, one dam or whatever. You need large projects. And the idea of Transaqua combines several aspects of integration in Africa, of economic integration and development. The first aspect being the water aspect, with a transfer, a huge water transfer from the Congo Basin to the Chad Basin, in order to rebuild the Lake Chad, the dimension this lake had 30, 40 years ago, and start to develop large areas with agricultural as agricultural areas there where today we have basically desert. The other aspect is transport. The way to do this, according to the Italians, was to the simplest but the most brilliant way was to build a 2,400 kilometers long canal going through Congo and the Central African Republic to Chad. in order to be able to catch from each of the tributaries of the River Congo enough water that could go over the threshold in terms of replenishing Lake Chad. And they are talking about between 70 and 100 billion cubic meter of water per year. And this canal would be huge transportation way, the first such way that would connect Central African countries as a transport connection. Of course, you build the canal, but you build also roads along the canal. You can also build a railway. And since the canal is going to produce electricity through various dams, then you can electrify whatever you build along the canal, roads or railways. Now, the other aspect which LaRouche identified by calling this project, Transaqua project, a small Nawapa project, is the aspect of bioengineering. Because what you want to do, you want to reverse the rain cycle in the Sahel region, which is being desertified. It's being desertified because more water evaporates than the water that comes through from the mountains. So we want to reverse this. And Transaqua is the first step to do this, along with many other projects which are there on the paper for northern Africa. Now, let me add the historical dimension of this. The author of the Transaqua project, Mr. Vicky, he is part of a generation of experts, of engineers, who were part of the effort of rebuilding the nation in the post-war period in Italy. But it's typical of other parts of the world, where the input they got in terms of reference and in terms of method, approach and way of thinking was the Roosevelt experience in the United States. Very directly so. And the policy is the same, and in an interview which Mr. Vicky gave us, he basically says that this is the spirit which animated them, his generation at that time, that there was a very, very strong motivation, and that their identification historically was not only with the experience, it was with the recent experience in of Roosevelt in the United States and the New Deal, and back in history, back to Leonardo da Vinci, of course, being Italians. But just to make this very concrete, after the war, Italy was destroyed economically because of the war, but also was underdeveloped because fascism, despite all the mythology you can read in books, fascism and Mussolini, although they had full power, dictatorial power for 20 years, they couldn't manage because they didn't want to transform the country from a peasant country into an industrial country. I don't say a farmer or agricultural country. I say peasant because the condition of peasants was very close to slavery, especially in southern Italy. So at the end of the war, Italy was destroyed by the war and had this terrible heritage of underdevelopment. So a group of leading people which were part of the leading political class in Italy decided to adopt the approach of the Roosevelt administration, and especially studying what was done in the Tennessee Valley Authority, with the Tennessee Valley Authority, to transform southern Italy from a peasant underdevelopment region into a modern farming, agricultural economy with infrastructure. And one of the key persons into this, who was leading this effort in the institutions for southern Italy, then moved to the engineering company which Marcello Vicchi was a part of, and it was his leader, his name is Francesco Curato. It was this man, Mr. Curato, who told Vicchi to study the approach for changing things in Africa with a large project from the Congo Basin to the Chad Basin. So this is very inspiring, this thing, and that's the tradition we are reviving. And Mr. Vico, despite his age and some infirmities, is very happy to do this and see that there is a lot of interest in such projects. He was able to see, for example, in the conference they had in Paris, where Sebastian, I think, was there. He can tell us more about it.
Yeah. I think what is very interesting in the NAWAPA principle that Lynn just put a few months ago is this question of reorganizing the physical space-time of the biosphere, you know. And when we discussed with Marcello in France, we were discussing of a recent report, you know, which has been published by two engineers of the United States of America for an AWAPA project, not NAWAPA, but AWAPA, which is African Water and Power Alliance. And it has been published by Mr. Cooper and Mr. Fuller, and I just finished to translate it in French right now. And it's very, very, very interesting because you have not only you have the Transaqua project for which we are fighting with Marcello Vicchi, but you have also the huge development of the Democratic Republic of Congo, you know, and the Republic of Congo, which is Congo-Kinshasa and Brazzaville. So you have a big development project. You have just to imagine it, you know, the future Africa, you know, with, let's say, 9,000 kilometers, you know, which is at almost 6,000 miles of railway network connected, you know, with energy, transport, freight, passenger, water management system. You have a kind of a loop, you know, and it's very well described, very precisely in this report, you know. And you can see that with all the work, you know, that we have done with this Marcello Vicchi, with what Lynn did in the past, you know, and now with the NAWAPA project, and people are taking it back, you know, and revive it. And when we presented what Porsche presents in Jamena, you know, and what we discussed with people was exactly that. We were discussing the future of Africa, you know, and people were totally challenged by that because they are used to think as we are wanting them to think, which is just die and that's all. We will not save you, you know. And when we presented it, you know, it was very, it's beautiful to see how, as Porsche said, people react to this long-term, you know, infrastructure development project as we presented it. And I think we have to be the new Marcello Vicchi and all these people reviving all this project. Because I don't know if you know that, but in France, after the 1876 Centennial Exposition in the U.S., you have a lot of people, you know, working already as Elie Rouder, for example, or Adolphe Duponchel, which was working on the Trans-Saharan Railway, you know, to have a railway network between Algeria and Sudan already, you know, at the end of the 19th century. So it's a real historical fight, we can say, between the one who want a real physical development and this Euro system of today, you know, which is the British Empire system. And it's funny also to see that historically, and that we are here right now today reviving this tradition, which have almost disappeared, you know, in the culture, at least in France.
Yes, I want to thank you. Let me add here, we only have a minute and a half left, but people, I'm going to give the phone number again for those of you who listen on the phone. You can go on our website, of course, larouchepub.com, but here it is, 800 2783135. I'm going to repeat it because on the enemy side of who suppressed everything that Sebastian just described in the last couple hundred years, we have Dope Inc., the book, to make clear. And you know, we have a few hundred left, less than 500, maybe only 400 or 300. I want you to call and get more. Thank you for calling last week. Many of you did. And that number, I repeat, for the book Dope Incorporated, Dope Inc., 800-278-3135, 800-278-3135. It was first published, Dope Inc., that gave the British pedigree on who the enemy is of the imperialists back in the 1970s. This very time that our three guests have just described, when there were still on the drawing boards development of our planet, but the floating currencies and all the other casino economics that was put in, especially after 1971, has subverted it, and now it's all back on the agenda. Portia, we only have a few seconds, but if you want to say goodbye to people, I'd like you to do that, to reiterate any point you wish to make about our opportunity.
Sure. I just want to tell people that we had a series of NWAPA conferences in Germany discussing all of these projects. And one thing that we had was, where's the money going to come from? These are wonderful projects, but who's going to pay for it? And I just want to ask people to go back to the beginning of the discussion about the crisis that we're in, without Glass-Steagall, without destroying the British Empire, and going back to fixed exchange rates so that we can do finally what Franklin Roosevelt's dream was, what future generations expect from us. And I want to announce for everybody, you'll hear about it more next year, that we are launching a Berlin campaign to crush the green ideology here in Germany, and I want you to look out for that.
Oh, that's great. And we won't wait till the new year, but I'm glad you're doing it now. So this is the end of the LaRouche Show for November 27th, 2010. I thank Sebastian, Portia, and Claudio. Thank you very much.
Goodbye.
Okay, goodbye.
Goodbye. Bye.